All right, welcome to class today.
Glad to see you all here.
Before we begin, are there comments, questions, concerns, other things for me?
Okay, then let us look at the online quiz. We have some things to say about this.
Starting with the first question, which 4% of you got correct? All right, by far, you selected the answer that is structured like the math. What is wrong with answer A? Where is answer A incorrect logically? Implication is not causation. Okay, so perhaps because this is actually isn't going to be the main problem with this one. Yeah. Yeah, I have a not and not, but here I have a not and. When I distribute a not into an and, what does the and become? An or. So if I said, I don't feel good or I'm not a duck, then that would have been correct. But if you try to make the truth table for this, it won't line up because it has an and instead of an or it has the nots distributed, depending on your perspective. Now, that B is correct is weird. So let's just briefly talk about how we get to B being correct. Okay, so this version is A and B implies the not of C, C, and D. Okay, and as we just talked about, if we push that not through, we get A and B implies not C or not D. Okay, but here I'm saying I can only eat the rotten apple and feel good if I'm a duck, which doesn't seem to match up with this particularly at all. Okay, so to see this more fully, it's a little bit strange, but if I do A and B with a not, or not C or not D, and then not A or not B or not C or not D. The original statement just says one of them has to be false. Okay, using our equivalence rules. And one way of reordering that is we say the duck is going to be the antecedent, so we can say the duck implies, and then all of those other things. So the duck implies either not apple or not rotten or not good. And then we can use De Morgan's law to say the duck implies the not of all three of those, which now looks much more like this sentence. That's a lot of work. And partly I asked this question to sort of point out that structure is not the first thing you need to look at. This is a relatively common kind of mistake in actual proofs we do. Yes?
So I'm just a little confused. Basically say that all four of them are true?
I can only eat the rotten apple and feel good if I'm a duck. Oh yeah, maybe I've done this wrong.
Like in choice B, if all four of them are true, then choice B evaluates as true, but one of them...
Right, so this is claiming that if I eat the rotten apple and feel...
If I eat the rotten apple and feel good, then that implies, if I eat the rotten apple and feel good, that implies I'm a duck. Does that work here? So that becomes true implies the not. Yeah, so that is incorrect. Sorry, there's no correct answer. I apparently typed this incorrectly when I was typing it up and didn't even bother looking because I knew what I was intending. This is also a common problem. Yes. Explain what? So this is claiming that eat the rotten apple, feel good, I'm a duck. So that implies that if all four of these are one, it should be true. Is the original statement true if all four of them are one?
No, that becomes true implies false. The one thing that's false. So, yeah. So I think none of them are false, true then. So we'll be dropping this question because there's no correct answer. I apologize for my mistake. However, it does get across the point I was going for, which is it's easy to make mistakes. It's easy to make mistakes to follow the structure without thinking too carefully about what you've done with your knots. So when symbolizing things, it's always important to think about where did you put your knots? Did you move them between the logic and the English? And it's also important to make sure that you do your logic correctly as you move along. So yeah, that one will be dropped, which will boost everybody's score. Hooray. All right, other questions about this one? Okay. The others, we, I think, had majority correct at each of them to some degree. We accepted two different answers for this one because whether you decide to make a positive or negative for the second half could vary. We didn't accept these, though. What's wrong with these? You treat me implies you don't like this. Yeah. Yeah, you treat me as a proposition, unless we change what treat means. Okay? Remember, they have to be true or false. And so we will talk today about how we would write things like, how are you treating me, and so forth. But it'll be beyond propositions. For these, mostly people got them correct. There were always some people that were confused, some of them more than others. But you can, one way to have done these is to make a bunch of truth tables and see which one is, it holds up. I don't know that I have a whole lot to say about these. Unsurprisingly, as they got more complicated, we got more wrong answers, including this very strange one here. It's odd that you have an by implication C being anything, but nonetheless you do. Anyway, so these are there, and I don't know that I have a lot to say about them. Questions about questions 3 through 7? Okay. Yeah?
Is there like a quicker way to do it than just doing tables? It felt like it was really labor-like, or it took a lot of writing and stuff.
So your equivalence rules can also do it. Which one is faster depends on how much time you spend on each. Other questions? I guess a little bit of a trick here. When you're thinking about your entailments, entailments can be false only in one case, right? So entailment is false if you can find some way to make this true and that false. So you can sort of intelligently sample those cases to see if they seem to hold up in those cases. That doesn't help you if they both do, and you have to decide is it equivalent or not. Yeah. All right. We did pretty good with distributive rule. Hooray. And then there's question 9. I bolded one, I bolded single, I linked to our axioms, and still the majority of you answered things that require two or more axioms to get to. To get from here to here, for example, requires the definition of or implication. Oh, that is correct. My key is bad. My key is very bad. No, it's not, right? Yes, no, it requires double negation and then implication. The rule is that not A or B turns into A implies B. I don't have the form not A implies B here. So you have to put not not and then use the rule. So that's two rules, double negation followed by definition of implication. You can get there. It's two rules. Same thing here. Okay? To pull the not out front and put the nots in here, you first had to double negate this one and then apply Morgan's rule. Do I super care about the fact that double negation is a separate step? I'm not sure I do, and I'll probably end up dropping B and E. I was planning to do that when I created the quiz, but nonetheless, it is two steps, not one. Yes?
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, because did you say double negation is a simplification, not an equivalence?
Sorry, simplifications aren't equivalences. They're under the equivalences set in that page. Yeah?
How do we get to B? I apply distributive law backwards. I undistribute the B. Yeah. It is not. The definition of implication is not A implies B. Sorry, not A or B turns into A implies B. I don't have a not here. So I have to get the not there with double negation and then apply the definition. Yes?
So why do you mean, like, straightly apply De Morgan's rule to E?
Why can't we apply De Morgan's rule to get to E? I can't apply De Morgan's rule to this expression at all.
But, like, could we, like, formally wrong? Like, from E, we apply De Morgan's rule to change it to the...
If I applied De Morgan's rule to this, I would end up with not B and not A. Right? Yeah.
Can you use a distributive law with like nots, like negations? Like, could you like distribute a negation or like undistribute one?
So the rule that distributes negations is called De Morgan's law. Yeah. Why did I do this? Why would I make you think it's such small steps? Because the temptation, particularly when you start doing logic, is to allow your intuition to lead, and it will lead you astray. Okay, so I am trying to force you to think about rules and steps. Okay, now, in the real world, when you finally write a proof, you will skip steps too. But along the way, we're going to try to teach you to be very methodical, one rule at a time, right? And the rule of De Morgan says I need a knot on both of them to pull a knot out front. The rule of De Morgan says that the implication needs to have a knot in front of the or, right? Understanding what the rules say and thinking in that very tedious kind of way will help train your brain to think carefully in the future. I also knew that most of you with the D&E were correct. So my plan is to go back to my office after this is over and either decrease their weight or drop them entirely. I will think about that when I'm not on the spot. But I did want to make this point that thinking in very detailed steps is an important thing to do. And then we have question 10. Oh, wow, that was weird. Clicked the wrong thing. All right, question 10. Okay, at some level this, I don't know. This is an odd question to ask, I suppose. I have given you a vague statement about a disjunction of conjunctions, and I want to get some of the terms in the conjunctions to cancel out. And then I give you five things. First, let's start with the most obviously false. The commutative and associative property of disjunction and conjunction only work internally. So I can distribute and commute within conjunction, within disjunction, but not between them. And so if I'm trying to get different conjunctions to cancel out, that's not going to help me. De Morgan's laws will let me swap conjunctions to disjunctions and vice versa, which would you'd think then let me commute and associate. Except they always have knots in front of parentheses, so you still can't do that. Okay? And so we saw an example in class, and there were some in the lab practice and so forth, that this just didn't make progress, and it won't. It just doesn't. Okay? De Morgan's law isn't a way of making progress into mixing conjunctions as disjunctions. It is a way of changing them between each other if you're looking for a particular form or want to get an implication, but doesn't help you make progress here. Whereas the distributive law in either direction, yeah. So, thoughts, comments, questions about any of these pieces? All right. And we'll talk more about the in-class quiz after we have it graded tomorrow and turned back to you, so we'll talk about that on Wednesday. The other thing I want to talk about is a design challenge of designing curriculum. I generally try to hide from you the fact that curriculum gets designed, but the next three topics are sort of interrelated. And I'm going to try to tease them out and talk about them one at a time because talking about all three at once will be overloading. I'm not going to do a perfect job. Sorry. So there may be moments, particularly today, maybe also Wednesday, I hope not, but that you're like, there's a lot of things coming at me. We'll sort of try to sort those out, and I'll try my best to sort of keep them relatively separate as we go along. And so, let us start today with a motivating problem. There is a question. This is a very famous question in computer science. The question is there some input that makes my algorithm run forever? This question may not sound particularly interesting. In fact, if you think about the programs you have written thus far, you probably can answer this question about all of them. Most of them, the answer will be no. No set of inputs will make it run forever. And if you don't think the answer will be unambiguously yes, here is how you put the input that will make it run forever. But this question turns out to be sort of a seminal question that we can show you can't always know the answer. And when you take computational theory, you'll get to learn about why we can show you can't always know the answer and get to learn some interesting proofs about that and so on. This problem is famous enough that it is called the Halt problem and is always spelled in all capitals because it's so mean. You'll get to learn more about it later. This problem is not what I'm trying to tell you about, but I'm trying to motivate how would I take this question and write it in logic. We want to show that we can either prove yes or no to this question, which means we need to formalize it in math, which means we need to turn it into logic. But this question isn't a great question to turn into logic. The propositions we have so far, how many atomic propositions are in this question? Turn to your neighbor, see if you can identify atomic propositions in this question. Okay, I've written up a proposition. I'm not claiming it's atomic or simple, but it's one that came fairly obvious to me. I just took out the is there. The right algorithm runs forever on some input. So we may have other atomic propositions we could break this into or different atomic propositions we could use. Okay, so if this is just one atomic proposition, it's going to be hard to use logic to say anything about it. Because it's just one thing. And so how am I supposed to know if it's true or false using logic? We want a fancier form of logic that will allow us to recognize there is structure here. Okay? For example, how do I know there's some input that makes it run forever? I need to find that input. Inputs, there's lots of inputs I could pick. That is, in some sense, something that could change. And a proof of this would only need to be one input that runs forever, and then some proof that it runs forever on it. Okay? And so I want to have some ability to recognize this sentence, although an atomic proposition, is not made out of only one piece. It is made out of smaller pieces. Okay? And so we have dealt with propositions. We're going to now talk about a thing that can make propositions can be made out of, and they're going to be called predicates. And I will give you a few mnemonics in a moment to remember the difference between predicate and proposition. But first, let's just talk about what a predicate is. A predicate is an incomplete proposition. It's a proposition with blanks. Okay? So I could say, for example, something runs forever on something. This would be a predicate. And this incomplete proposition could be turned into a lot of different propositions depending on what I put in the blanks. Right? I could pick any algorithm, I could pick any input, and my predicate would turn into a proposition for every possible pair of things I could select. And so predicates, these incomplete propositions, are going to be an important component of expressing the things we want to express. Propositions are occasionally nice, but more often we're going to want these predicates to try to express the complexities of the real world. Let me just give you a few mnemonics to remember these two words. I don't intend to drill you on the vocabulary of these words, but I also don't intend for you to go out into the world, use the wrong word, and embarrass yourself. So I'm going to give you some mnemonics. Now, these are not based on the actual meaning of the words, because the actual meaning of the words are weird Latin things having to do with heralds crying things in the street. Anyway, we might look at this first letter that differs. We have an O and an E. The proposition is one thing that is true or false, where the predicate could be everything. This is just a mnemonic, right? But hopefully this will help you. You can also say, ooh, the proposition has one position. It is sort of fixed in position. Whereas the predicates, they really need to eat. They need more stuff to be complete. I don't know if these will help you. They may not. You're welcome to try to come up with your own. But they're both words you probably don't use very often. And if you use them outside of math, you use them to mean something different than they mean in math. And so here they are, at some effort to try to help you understand. Proposition, a complete, single, fixed sentence, true or false. A predicate, an incomplete thing that could be instantiated in a lot of different ways and needs extra information to become something that could be true or false. Question about these general ideas. Okay. We'll want predicates in lots and lots of different circumstances as we move forward. And lots of sentences we'll want to deal with will be based on predicates. There's an example from one of our textbooks in the reading for today. Let's actually just pull it up, shall we? Because I think it's a pretty good example. Oh, not that. Not that. Here we are. All right, so if we go and we open up the MCS book, no, the 4LX book, and then whatever the reading chapter was, I think it was chapter 21, right? Yes, chapter 21. All right, let me go down to chapter 21. There is an interesting example here. At least I think it's interesting. It's the very first one. Willard is a logician. All logicians wear funny hats. Therefore, Willard wears a funny hat. Hey, now, do you agree that if the first two things are true, the third thing would be true? Do you agree that we should be able to prove Willard wears a funny hat if we knew these first two things? Okay? But if we try to do it with propositions, we end up with three propositions, and we end up with a weird trying to prove, right? L and A proves F. There is no interrelationship in the propositions alone. Okay? And so the goal of predicates is to get across not just there are blanks, but the idea the same thing can appear in multiple blanks. And that same thing in multiple blanks gives us extra logical power. Because I can then say, you know what, there's an important thing about L and F. They're both about Willard. There's an important thing about A and F. They're both about funny hats. And understanding these commonalities between L and A are both about logicians, right? We have this connections between our propositions, and those connections appear to some degree in the blanks. And so we're going to want a useful way of describing what is in the blank. And so what we're going to put in the blanks is going to be variables. Now, computer science has, especially if you speak English, bad choices for names. Many technical and scientific disciplines, they pick some dead language for their technical terms. They'll pick a version of Latin that is not spoken in Italy anymore, or the like, to turn all their terms, and so nobody knows what they were supposed to mean, and they only mean one thing. And instead, computer scientists decide we'll mostly use English and occasionally math. And then we redefine all of the terms. Variable is one you're going to have to know multiple definitions of at the same time. Okay? Code and math, and I suppose we could also do stats because that's also different. In code, a variable means sort of, I don't know, a changeable named value. And so you have seen things, for example, you've almost certainly seen in code at some point, some expression like x equals x plus 1, which in code means make x bigger.
Okay? Now, math, in math, this means an unchangeable unknown. I don't know what it is, it's something, but it's only one thing. It's never going to change. And so in math, if I say x equals x plus 1, what have I said?
0 is equal to 1.
I've said nonsense. I have said there can be no x. I have said contradiction. There is no real number for which x equals x plus 1. Now, for infinite numbers, there can be, depending on which model of infinity you use, right? But in math, this same sentence, spelled the same way, is a contradiction. Doesn't mean anything. It's a bad thing to write. We're in code, we write it all the time. Because we call them both variables, we write them both the same way, but they mean very different things. This class is discrete mathematics. We are teaching you computer science, but we're teaching you in math language. When we talk about variable, we're going to mean the second thing. Okay? When we talk about a variable, unless we're talking explicitly about code, we mean it never changes. We may not know what its value is, but it's got one and only one value. Everywhere and always that it appears. Okay? Stats is sort of like math. There's this idea of random variables, and there's distributions and so on, and I don't feel a need to go into those right now, but you may bump into them at some point as well. And they're also slightly different than the others. So we have to deal with this because if I just decided to give them different names, nobody else would know what you were talking about when you moved on with your life, so we're going to use the same terms as everybody else. So variables are what we're going to call the thing, and in math sense, we're going to call those things that go in the blanks. Right? So we're going to talk about this being, I don't know, maybe that's x and that's y. We're just going to give them variables to refer to them. Okay? And the way we're going to formalize them, right? This thing we just formalized as a letter. And these, because they have variables, we're going to formalize in a way that's going to look like a function. So we're going to define predicates. It is traditional to use a capital letter for the name of the predicate and lowercase letters for the variables. Oh, that's just a very strong tradition, not a hard and fast rule. Okay, we'll define a predicate to be an incomplete proposition with the variables for the blanks, different names for the variables, and it will behave to many degrees like a function. However, it's a function is either true or false. If you give me any specific x or y, I'm always going to say true or false. Because it turns into a proposition when I have values for the variables, not something else. Note, though, that the variables do not themselves need to be propositions, and in general are not. They can come from these larger concepts of algorithms or inputs. Okay? So lots of different value types can be put in the parentheses, but the end result is going to be true or false. Questions about our definition so far? Okay. Then let's think a little bit more. Let me take a slightly simpler predicate to start playing with. I'm going to say my algorithm is faster than yours. This is a claim. We could argue it's a proposition. It's either true or it's false, assuming I know what my algorithm is and your algorithm is. But it turns out this is a claim we often want to make. We often want to say, I did something better than you. Haha, pay me more money. But this is almost never universally true. It is almost always the case for any reasonably defined algorithm that there are some inputs on which it is faster and some inputs on which it is slower. And so as we think about this proposition, there are several ways we can make a predicate out of it. I could have the idea that one thing is faster than another. I could also have my algorithm is faster on input something. Oh, I could even try to combine them. I could say something is faster
than something on something.
Okay? There's multiple ways I could take what I'm trying to say and turn it into predicates. Unlike with our atomic propositions, there isn't just one way of doing it. I can't just make them atomic and be done. I could even argue that I could say something is something than something on something. And add blanks all over the place. How do I decide what blanks to put in? The trick here, the challenge in figuring out what blanks to put in here, is based on what is it that I want to be able to say. If I want to be able to compare lots of different algorithms, then the algorithm should be variables in my predicate. If I only have one algorithm I'm interested in, or a pair of algorithms I'm interested in, then I don't need that to be a variable in my predicate. I could just fix it in place. And so as we're thinking about this idea of having predicates, there's some judgment, there's some understanding of context that helps you figure out where do the blanks go and what are the blanks. And in general, you want to blank for anything that might be shared across things you're going to say and not for the other stuff. If it's not going to change, just leave it alone. And so it depends somewhat on the context of what I'm trying to say. And so this judgment call, I can't just give you the magic thing to understand it. I can't give you the definition of atomic or the like to get there. You're going to have to understand it from context. One thing to look for is what kinds of things are you saying. Okay? So, let's just take a little example. Let's take, how about we'll define the L predicate? Okay? And I'm going to define the L predicate to mean one thing loves another thing. Okay? Now, it's nice to talk about something loving something else. And we could argue there's multiple kinds of love. You love Kate differently than you love your roommates, differently than you love your significant other, I hope. Okay. But we could start with this basic predicate. What if I want to use this predicate to talk about, to make the following claim? I want to make the claim, everyone loves me.
Okay. How would I formalize this idea of everyone loves me with my L predicate? I might be tempted to say, L, everyone, me.
And this can make some sense to try to say this, except does it make sense to put everyone in my predicate? When I'm thinking about my predicate, I have my variables. One of the things we're going to keep from both math and computer science about variables is variables have type. Okay? What type of thing gets to go into my blanks? And let's assume that I'm going to say the type of thing I'm going to say, the type is going to be person. So I can say one person loves another person. If I decide this, me is fine. I believe I'm a person. But I do not believe that everyone is a person. Right? Everyone is a lot of different people. And so trying to say everyone belongs in a blank is a little odd. And if I'm going to try to prove that everyone loves me, I need to talk to each person individually. I couldn't just talk about the everyone collective, because there is no such collective. And so when we're dealing with our predicates, we're going to want to be able to do a couple of different things. We're going to be able to have our predicate. We're going to be able to describe what types it's talking about. We're going to want to be able to decide, the M variable refers to me. Okay? So we're going to be able to find particular variables that mean a particular instance of the world. And be able to just use those in my logic directly. But then I'm also going to want to be able to leave some variables sort of unbound. A variable that could mean anything. Okay? I want to be able to say, pick any person X. Person X loves me because I'm just that special. Right? And so I want to be able to say something for like, for all X, this is true.
Pick an x, any x, this will always be true. I want to be able to make these kinds of assertions. So as we're thinking about our predicates, we have variables. Our variables have types. We can have bound variables, meaning I know what they mean. They have a specific given meaning. Okay? And I can also have unbound variables. That means I haven't told you what this variable is yet. It could be anything. Maybe I'll tell you what it is later. I'm just leaving it undefined. And maybe I could say, for all x, but maybe I could be feeling a little depressed and just want to know, does anybody love me? Right? And so maybe instead of saying for all x, I could say, is there an x? Okay? And so there's different ways I could word this, and we'll formalize those with quantifiers mostly on Wednesday. We may get a little bit of that today. But we want to have this idea that we can have a general predicate with variables. We can bind some variables in some places. And maybe I really want to know, is there somebody that loves me that I also love? Because if somebody I don't like loves me, does that really help? So maybe I want to be able to say, you know what, ooh, and I want to love that same person. Okay? By using the same variable in both places, again, because this is math, not computer science, a variable has one meaning everywhere it appears. I don't know who this person is. I don't know who X is. But I know whoever X is, X loves me, and I love X. And so if I find one person I love and somebody else that loves me, that does not satisfy this logic. Questions about this idea? Okay. So, we have our predicates. Let me talk a little bit more about what I mean by the type. We're going to talk about the domain. The domain is the type of variables I didn't tell you what they are. Okay? So this is, in particular, it's the set of all allowed values of your variables. We will be more concrete and talk about how sets work next week, and then talk about how we can define formally what we mean by set. When we think about a data type, we think about integer or whatever you have in programming, or you think about person or true, false, and so on. Each of these defines a set of allowed values. And so when we're going to be turning English into predicate logic, we're going to specify the domain of our variables. We'll initially start where all the variables have the same domain. So we aren't going to talk about sentences that have a mixture of an algorithm here and an input there. We'll start with things that have a person in both spots kind of ideas. We'll get to that multiple kinds of domains as we talk more about sets next week. We have this idea of a domain. We have this idea of a variable and a predicate that we've also talked about. Okay? And with these pieces, we can make a large variety of more complicated sentences than we can with propositions alone. Okay. Whew. I've been talking at you a lot. Thoughts, comments, questions, anything that's confusing to you, why don't you take a moment, turn to your sitting next to you, and see if you can summarize either your confusions or what you understand.
Thank you.
Okay. Then let's move ahead and talk about quantifiers. Quantifiers.
Quantity is the idea of number. And we have these things we call quantifiers. They're not actually telling us about number.
There are two main quantifiers we're going to deal with, and they are written like this. An upside down capital A and a backwards capital E. Okay, we're gonna have these two quantifiers. This one is red, is pronounced for all. And this one is pronounced there exists.
But very often when we're dealing with predicates, what we're going to want to ask about our variable is, does this work for all variables? Does it work for at least one variable, or neither of those? Okay? Now, there could be cases where you want to say, are there at least three variables this works for? But those are rare enough that we only have special symbols for these two ideas. There's at least one, or it's true for everything. Okay? And the way we work this, there's several different syntaxes, and actually our two textbooks use different ones, just to be annoying. But the basic format is I'm going to say, for all x. And then either parentheses or a period. I'm going to use a period because I think it's slightly more common in computing. And then we have some predicate that uses x. So I could say, for example, x, x. If we take L as the predicate that says something loves something, this sentence reads, everything loves itself. Okay? I'm saying, for all x, it is the case that the love predicate holds when given itself. Everything loves itself. That is what this means. Is it true or not? Doesn't we can figure that out. This whole thing together is a proposition. Because it's either true or false. This is a predicate. Okay? And then we have only one variable used three different times. Once for the quantifier, and twice inside the expression. Okay? I guess we have our quantifier here. And then we have our variable. Our variable is there, and there, and there. Okay? So I can say, everybody loves themselves. I can also say, there exists somebody that loves themselves. Okay? So the first one means everybody loves themselves. The second one means somebody somewhere loves themselves. Which of these would be easier to prove? Yeah?
The latter.
Why?
Because you only need one example, whereas the first one you need every example.
Yeah. Right? For this one, all I have to do is find somebody that's willing to testify they love themselves. I love myself. Check. Done. Okay? For this one, I can ask everybody I know, and everybody I know knows, and still not know the truth of this sentence. Unless, somebody says they don't love themselves. This one is easy to disprove. Right? One person that doesn't love themselves disproves it. This one is easy to prove. One person that loves themselves proves it. The exists one is hard to disprove. To prove no one loves themselves, I have to look at everybody and make sure none of them love themselves. To prove that everyone loves themselves, also hard to do. I have to check everybody. And so we see there is a sort of a not relationship between for all and exists, right? At some level, proving exists and proving not for all are similar difficulty. Proving for all and not exists are similar difficulty, okay? And so we're going to formalize that here in just a moment. But before we do that, questions about the notation or the meaning of these quantifiers. Let's use that briefly and come back to say, if I wanted to say everybody loves me,
I would say for all x, x loves me. Right? So these quantifiers allow me to say everybody loves me. They allow me to say somebody loves me. They even allow me to say nobody loves me if I'm feeling particularly depressed this morning. I can say it's not the case that there exists somebody that loves me. Because I can combine my propositional logic with the proposition that is this combined thing. Okay? All right. What do I mean by for all? What do I mean by there exists logically? Okay? When I say for all x, p of x, what I am saying is p of x0 and p of x1 and p of x2 and up to the very last p. Now, this is not mathematical notation. If you see ellipses, it was a shorthand to tell some human what you meant. It is not something you can use in a proof. We'll get some more about that here in a moment. But a for all is an implicit and over everybody. Okay? So if I want to say, I don't know, everybody can blink. So P might be the can blink predicate. And this says the first person can blink, and the second person can blink, and the third person can blink, all the way up to the last person that exists. All people can blink. It's an and of them all. If I say instead there exists an X, where this is true, that is going to be an or. All the way up to the end. So when I talk about my exists and my for all, I'm really talking about these infinitely long strings of ands and ors. Okay? Or potentially infinite. This, however many there exist, I'm trying to say about either about all of them combined as an and with an and or an or. And understanding this allows us to use our basic logic predicates on our quantifiers. In particular, there's one that we're going to use quite often with quantifiers, which is the quantifier version of De Morgan's rule. If I say not all for not all x p of x, that is going to be equivalent, using De Morgan's law, I have a not over a bunch of ands. I can move that not inside the internal things and turn them to ors to get there exists something that it is not true for. Okay, this is just Morgan's law applied over the and of for all. And of course, the other direction of De Morgan's law also works here. Right? If I say there does not exist something, I put my parentheses in the wrong place, for which p of x, that is the same thing as saying for all things, it is not the case that p of x. This is going to allow us to change for alls into exists. As we need to do it. Thoughts, comments, questions? All right, we'll start talking about how we actually use this on Wednesday. One last thing in our last 30 seconds. There is a special symbol written backwards E with a slash through it. This is a special symbol. It means does not exist. This means the same thing as does not exist. And that shows up fairly often as a shorthand way of writing non-exist, so you should be aware of that. If we come back on Wednesday, we'll see how to do this, get some practice turning sentences into this. I will see you all on Wednesday.